Okie doke. So, without further ado, I want to move on then to look at some introductory material. So this is section one of the, you know, the main 10 sections. And I kind of expect that a fair amount of this you'll already be familiar with. So I'm going to go reasonably rapidly. As I said, bear in mind that in these 2 days, we can't possibly expect you to emerge tomorrow afternoon with your head, you know, fully switched on to all of this Bayesian stuff. And indeed, even reviewing material that you might be already familiar with, I think if we went at a pace that would be more typical of a normal undergraduate lecture, then, well, we'd be here till Wednesday evening. So I'm going to go fairly swiftly, but I'll slow down at key points to try and emphasise the most important ideas. So I want to begin just by thinking about what we mean by probability and what we mean by inferring parameters, inferring quantities from data, the essence of what data analysis is about. But what does that really mean? Well, if you look at the preface to Phil Gregory's book, he talks about statistical inference providing a means for assessing the plausibility of one or more competing models. That's a very much a textbook definition of what people usually mean by Bayesian inference. And this book by Davinder Sivia, which in his preface, what he says is that the most we can hope to do is to make the best inference based on the experimental data and any prior knowledge that we have available. Well, that sounds quite reasonable. Sounds as if that surely is the very least that you should be trying to do as a physical scientist. So Davinder Sivia goes on to set this in a slightly unusual historical context. He goes back to, of all people, Herodotus, who was a Greek around in about 500 BC, a philosopher and thinker. And here's a little quote from Herodotus, and he talks about military strategy. He talks about how if you're a military strategist, then, well, sometimes you get it right and sometimes you don't. And Herodotus refers to the fact that if you make the right decision, even if it leads to disastrous consequences, well, it still might have been the right decision based on the available data you had at the time. Without getting too political about it, it's not so many years ago we had all the stuff about the Iraq War and, you know, the dossier of evidence that was available on the basis of which countries made certain decisions. So, you know, if that genuinely was the best available evidence, then perhaps we can say that the countries made the right decision to go to war. There's been a lot of discussion ever since about whether indeed it was the best evidence or whether there was a bit of cherry picking went on. And Herodotus talks about that too. He says that, a decision would still be foolish even if you sort of got away with it if that decision was based on a misinterpretation of the facts or using bad information when the decision was made. So even if the consequences were the happiest possible, if the decision was the wrong thing to do at the time, then it's still a bad decision. So that's how a military strategist would put it. Well, in fact, in Bayesian inference, you encounter a lot of the same terminology. We talk about decisions, we talk about evidence, we talk about making the best decision, we talk about reason and rational judgments. And what we try to do in probability is to really attach quantitative meaning to some of those phrases. They don't just have the sort of fuzzy meaning that a politician might assign them, but hopefully they've got a meaning which will be mathematically very precisely defined. And for that, what we need is a theory of probability. And in fact, this goes back a long way. There's a chap called Pierre-Simon Laplace, who I'm sure many, if not all of you, have heard of in other contexts, who back in the early 1800s published a book on the theory of probability, and he said that probability theory is nothing but common sense reduced to calculation. Again, I don't think anyone could really take objection to that phrase, but how do you do it? Well, what we need is, exactly as Phil Gregory says, is a means for assessing the plausibility of one or more competing models. We need mathematical tools that will let you do that. So how's it going to work? we need to think about the difference between deductive and inductive logic, because the mathematical tools are not quite the same as you would meet in pure mathematics, where you set about proving that 2 plus 2 equals 4, and so on. So let's think of a way to sort of pictorially represent that. In the physical sciences, what we often have is theories of how the world works. And what we want to do is to use those theories to make predictions, to predict how we will be able to measure the effects in the real world. The trouble is, sometimes you have competing theories. So how do you decide which theory is correct? Well, the best way to do it is if you can somehow find one single observation that agrees with only one of the theories. And that would be the observation, if it were correct, if you hadn't messed up and, you know, there was something wrong with your instruments, that observation would be the thing that tells you that that theory is the true one and the others aren't, or at least it would allow you to rule out the other theories. I suppose another observation might come along later which would rule out this theory too. That's essentially how we've always approached the scientific method, is on the basis of ruling out the falsifiability of scientific theories. But the reality is that what we often find is that our observations will agree with multiple theories. So here's a very silly toy model example to try and illustrate how you might concoct a way of getting around that. Suppose statement A is that all red-haired students drink iron brew. And statement B is that student X has red hair. So according to the usual rules of deductive logic in mathematics, student X should drink iron brew because statement A implies statement C when you also have statement B being true. So if A is true, then if B is true, C is true, and if C is false, then B is false. So if the student doesn't drink iron brew, the student can't have red hair, according to this. C is a logical consequence of A and B. But in the physical sciences, life is never as simple as that. More often than not, what we're dealing with is a situation where you don't have absolute truth or absolute falsehood, you have somewhere in between. Unfortunately, as again, I'm sure maybe many of you will already be aware, there's a system of algebra that goes back to a chap called George Boole, which can deal with exactly that. Now, I'm not going to go through all the maths of this, it's not really a course about that, but if you want to read more about it, there's tons on this in the Phil Gregory book, or Devinder Sivia's book, or a couple of the others that I mentioned. And what it sets up is mathematical rules which can work even when you're dealing with situations where you don't necessarily have absolute truth or falsehood, but you have a number that's somewhere between 0 and 1. So let's think about how you might use that. Suppose we know that C is true, that student X drinks iron brew, and we know that statement A is true, that all red-haired students drink iron brew. What can you say about statement B, student X has red hair? Statement A didn't say that all students who drink iron brew have red hair. It just said that all red-haired students drink iron brew. So if you want to know something about the hair colour of student X, well, clearly the simplest way to do it is to have a look at their hair. But maybe that data isn't available. Maybe the only data you have is that student X drinks iron brew. What can you say? Well, you might suppose that if C is true, then B is more plausible. Because if we know that all red-haired students drink iron brew and student X is red hair, common sense would perhaps suggest that there's a reasonable chance that student X has red hair. What we want is a way to quantify that, to actually assign some hard numbers. And this is what developed from the ideas of Boolean algebra, extending Boolean algebra, like I said a moment ago, to a system that isn't just zeros and ones, that can deal with numbers in between 0 and 1. And we call those numbers probabilities. So if you assign the degree of plausibility of a statement, a real number between 0 and 1, then the rules for combining and operating on them are just the same as they were for the Boolean algebra, where it's exactly 0 or 1. They're identical, and we can call those numbers between 0 and 1 probabilities. So the mathematical foundations of all of this are beautifully written in this book by Ed James. The book was actually completed by his PhD students after he died. He'd written most of it before, but it wasn't yet published, and they put it together. It's called Probability Theory, The Logic of Science. It's a really very nice book indeed. But in a way, this takes us back to Laplace, because Laplace's idea that probability was just common sense reduced to calculation, well, the Boolean algebra now gives us a way to do those calculations. It tells us how to combine them. It provides us a mathematical framework for probability as the basis of plausible reasoning. Probability measures our degree of belief that something is true. So if the probability of statement X is 1, then that means that we are certain that X is true. If the probability that statement X is 0, then you're certain that X is false. But your degree of belief is always going to depend on what available background information you have. So what we often do is we write the probability that X is true given I here just represents background information. Now, I won't always write it this way because it gets a bit clumsy, but the textbooks I've recommended, they all make a big point about this at the beginning, because clearly if you've got different background information, then you might deduce different probabilities. So that vertical line, it's what we call conditional probability. Your state of knowledge about X is conditioned by the background information that you have. Now, there are simple rules for combining probabilities. I've already said that they follow the rules of Boolean algebra, and I left out the details, but let's just mention a couple of these rules. The first one is that if X is some statement that can either be true or false, then the probability that X being true plus the probability of X being false has to equal 1, because it can only be one or the other. But that's provided the background information is the same in both cases, because if you've got different background information, that could change the probabilities. And then there's a product rule for combining probabilities. Again, you might have met this before in a slightly different notational form. If you've got two propositions, X and Y, then the probability that X and Y are both true, you can write it as the probability of X being true given that Y is true multiplied by the probability that Y is true. And we call P of X given Y the conditional probability of X given Y, and also the background information I. And P of Y given I, that's known as the marginal probability for Y being true. Again, we'll see this notation a lot, so I'll come back to it multiple times in the next few slides and the next few lectures. Now, we can turn that the other way around. We can write P of y and x as P of y given x multiplied by P of x. But again, we'll have to be careful that you're talking about the same background information. And also, the probability of x given y isn't the same as y given x. Now, I know we're feeling we're all getting a bit bogged down in mathematical notation, so let's think of a slightly more day-to-day example. There was a rather weird story in The Guardian a couple of years ago about Casio F91W watches. Now, I've got one, just out of interest. How many people here have got one of these? Well, not many, but a few. Well, you might be a bit worried to learn that according to the US intelligence agencies, that the possession of this watch is the sign of Al-Qaeda, because it seems that a surprisingly high number of inmates of Guantanamo Bay have this watch. But again, if you think of the previous slide, the probability that you're a member of Al-Qaeda, given that you've got a Casio F91W watch, is surely not the same as the probability of having such a watch, given that you're a member of Al-Qaeda. Now, an even more direct example of where this equality doesn't hold is the probability of being pregnant, given that you're a woman, is not the same as the probability of being a woman, given that you're pregnant. So, although this might just seem like common sense, it's alarming to discover that the US intelligence agency doesn't quite seem to have got its head round this notion of conditional probability. Now, I, for one, have carried on wearing this watch and not worried too much about it. I would recommend that you do the same. But it does make you think about how poorly understood statistics often is out there in the real world. So essentially, if these two probabilities aren't equal, then how do you relate them to each other? You do it via the most fundamental equation in the whole 2 days, which is called Bayes' theorem. A good chunk of what we'll do will involve this equation. It says that the probability of y given x can be written as the probability of x given y times the probability of y divided by the probability of x. Now that all still seems a bit abstract, so let's think about it in terms of how Bayes himself was trying to approach this. In fact, Bayes didn't really get the credit during his own lifetime for this. He was a Church of England minister, and Pierre Laplace rediscovered his work after Bayes had died, and he published it a couple of years later because, you know, Bayes wasn't really in it for the sort of the scientific glory. But he had hit upon a very important principle that we can use in doing data analysis in the physical sciences. So let's think about it in a way that's a bit more useful for all of you. Not all of these abstract x and y's, but let's think about it in terms of models and data. What we're seeing is that the probability for a particular model being true, given some data that you've gone and observed, can be written as the probability of obtaining that data given that the model's true, multiplied by the probability that the model's true, divided by the probability that you would obtain that data. There are terms for all four elements of this equation. We call the thing on the left-hand side the posterior probability, meaning the probability after you've got some data. The rightmost term on the numerator is called the prior probability, the probability before you get some data. The P of data given model we call the likelihood. Maybe you've heard that term before, even if you haven't heard anything about data analysis, because that's used in classical, traditional statistics as well. And then the term on the denominator is known as the evidence, or the marginalized likelihood. We won't really talk about the evidence at all today, but we'll come back to it tomorrow when we look at a relatively new methodology called model selection in Bayesian inference, which allows you not so much to compare parameters of a given model, but to compare one model with another. The crucial thing is that in many, many situations, you can calculate what these terms are. You can develop mathematical models, mathematical functions that describe what these terms are. So that means you can work out posterior probabilities for your model given the data. In fact, there's another way we can write it. We can say that the posterior, well, let's go from right to left, that the prior is what you knew before you did an experiment. The likelihood is the influence of your measurements or observations, and then the posterior is what you know after you've done your experiment. So this afternoon, we'll have a look at some specific examples of how your posterior evolves as you gather more data. So I'll take you through some kind of simulated experiments to show how the posterior will be affected as you gather more and more data. And then tomorrow, we'll talk about how you define priors, because that's the probability you assign before you've gone and gathered any data. And sometimes that's no more than an educated guess, but there are some quite sophisticated ideas using maximum entropy, something that you sort of encountered a bit in statistical mechanics, so it's got a good solid physics grounding as well. There's some very neat and powerful tools using maximum entropy for defining prior probabilities. But as we'll see a bit later on this morning, or maybe this afternoon, provided your data are good enough, it shouldn't really matter that much what you choose the prior to be. If your data aren't very good, then really all you're going to be basing your posterior on is your prior knowledge, and you might almost say your prior prejudice, because the data aren't really telling you anything much. So clearly what you want to be is in a situation where the data dominate, where the problem is likelihood dominated. Unfortunately, in many physical science situations, that's exactly where we are. So that's, you had a very sort of rapid and quite intensive burst of Bayesian ideas, just kind of set the scene for what we're going to explore in a lot more detail over these 2 days. Ideas about priors, posteriors, likelihoods, how you put them together, and how you use them to make inferences about physical models. But the Bayesian ideas are relatively new. In a sense, they're also quite old, because they go all the way back to people like Laplace and Bayes himself. But they dropped out of fashion. They dropped out of fashion big time. And really, it was only in the last few decades, at least in physics, that Bayesian methods have been sort of coming back to the fore again. Although they were around in statistics for quite a bit longer. So they're seen now, I guess, as sort of state of the art. But what have we been busy doing in between? Bayesian probability theory was rejected for a long time. So what was it rejected in favour of? The basic problem was that a lot of people felt that this idea of probability as a degree of belief was too subjective. After all, what you believe might not be the same as what I believe. So how do you work out probabilities? And that led to what is known as the frequentist approach. And it's perhaps the sort of intuitive interpretation of probability that most of you have encountered, if you've encountered anything in your undergraduate studies. It's the idea that probability is to do with the relative frequency of outcomes when you perform a large series of experiments. Suppose you're rolling a die. How many times do you get a 1? Well, our common sense would suggest that the probability of getting a 1 should be a 6th if it's a normal die. In fact, tomorrow we'll look at how in Bayesian probability theory we can actually justify that common sense assumption using maximum entropy. But let's assume it is a 6. Well, how would you test that? Well, what you'd have to do is you'd have to roll the die a large number of times and count the number of times you get a 1 and divide by the number of times you've rolled the die. So in frequentist probability theory, you think of rolling the die as generating a random variable. The probability of getting a 1 is a fixed number. It's out there. Nature knows what it is. It's just we don't. But we can estimate it by performing a large number of experiments. And every time you roll the die, you're going to possibly get a different number. It'd be pretty weird if you got a 1 every time. And you can't predict from one roll to the next what the number is going to be, but you do expect that if you roll it a very large number of times, then you should get a 1 about 1/6 of the time. So you can define the probability of getting a 1 as a limit as the number of die rolls tends to infinity. And if P of 1 does indeed turn out to be a 6, then you can announce, after the fashion, that you think the die is fair. But there's a bit of a logical loophole here, because calculating the probability of getting a 1 as just the ratio of the number of 1s divided by the total number of die rolls, that's actually assuming that each outcome is equally likely or equally probable. So in order to prove that each number is an equally probable outcome, you've effectively got to assume that each number is an equally probable outcome. Now, I'm being slightly unfair to frequentist methods because there are ways in which you can get around that a little, but they do become quite elaborate. And the straightforward sort of common sense interpretation, we roll the die a large number of times, count the number of ones, divide by the total number of die rolls, is rather prone to this logical inconsistency. It also assumes, maybe a more serious issue, that you've got an infinite series of identical trials. Well, clearly you don't. You've only rolled the die a finite number of times. But two problems with that. One is, can't the probability change? As, after all, if you keep rolling the die a large enough number of times, the edges are going to wear down. Maybe that will change the probabilities. And secondly, if you only roll the die a finite number of times, you want to be able to say something about the probabilities based on that finite number of outcomes. What can you say about the fairness of the die after you've only rolled it 5 times or 100 times or 10 times? Now, we'll see this afternoon that the Bayesian framework lends itself very naturally to doing that. But the frequentist framework can be arranged to do it too. The way you do it is by introducing mathematical machinery to do with what we call estimators. So before we get into the details of that, let's just think of a kind of simple pictorial example. On your calculator or even your phone or certainly your laptop or desktop computer, you'll have built in a random number generator. It will generate a random number between 0 and 1. And tomorrow, we'll look at ways in which you might test whether those random number generators actually work properly. Because they don't really generate random numbers, they just generate numbers from a very long sequence of deterministic numbers where there isn't really any kind of deterministic predictability from one number to the next. So to all intents and purposes it's random, but it's not really. Now if you generate numbers which are drawn from 0 to 1, you can define something that we call a probability density function. We'll define that more formally in a few minutes. But the probability density function for uniform numbers between 0 and 1 is just a straight line. In fact, I haven't put a scale on the axes, but the height here should be 1. It's a horizontal line. If you only generate 100 random numbers, then you don't expect that you're going to get 10 of them between 0 and 0.1, another 10 between 0.1 and 0.2, another 10 between 0.2 and 0.3, and so on. You might expect that you're going to have maybe a bit less in one of the bins of your histogram and a bit more in another bin. It might look a bit like this. The question is that close enough to the model, what you expect, a horizontal straight line, that you're content that your numbers really did come from the random number distribution that you expected? What do people think? Do you think that's good enough? It's kind of hard to say. Maybe if you did 10,000 trials, you'd expect that the deviations from the expected model are going to be smaller. But are they small enough? Well, later on this morning and this afternoon, we'll look at how you could really do that. You could quantitatively test whether these data or these data are consistent with the model. We do it using something called a chi-squared test, which I imagine many of you will have maybe used or at least heard of before. That's one way to do it. There's a whole bunch actually, but chi-squared has proven to be very popular in the physical sciences. It's quite easy to implement, but there are certain assumptions it's based on, and if those assumptions aren't true, then you're going to get the wrong inference about your test. But the basic principle is that what we need is a method to decide whether the observations are close enough to the prediction to be content that they really do come from the model that you think they do. If they're not close enough, then what you do is you reject that model in favour of another model. So frequentist probability theory has developed a lot of mathematical machinery to let us do all of that, and we'll look at that later on this morning. So bottom line is, who's right when it comes to Bayesian versus frequentist? That's a tough question to answer. I think it's fair to say I am a dyed-in-the-wool Bayesian, but to use the common cliche, some of my best friends are frequentists, and I try not to be too evangelistic about it. In a sense, if you look at what we discussed in terms of rolling dice, and what we discussed in terms of this simple example with random numbers, well, the physical sciences are full of experiments where that's essentially what we do. We repeat the experiment a large number of times, and we try to draw inferences from the outcomes. Look at the Large Hadron Collider, look at various experiments in nuclear physics, and even if it's just a lab-based experiment that you yourself are running, you're probably going to want to run it a few times to get a sense of whether the answer you got is typical of the answer you might expect time after time. So we're a kind of a hybrid of Bayesian and frequentist ideas in the physical sciences, because often what we try to do is to repeat experiments a large number of times to satisfy ourselves that our experimental equipment is behaving properly. But we don't necessarily want to repeat experiments an infinite number of times. That would be a bit hard, and after all, you want to finish your PhD. So often, what you find is that Bayesian methods are taking hold because we want to be able to make the best inference we can, even with only limited data, maybe even with only a few data sets at our disposal. And one of the chief objections that frequentists used to have about Bayesians back shortly after Laplace and Bayes and all of those guys, one of the chief objections was about the subjectivity of assigning probability. The Bayesians have got it all wrong, because assigning probability as a degree of belief is too simplistic, because degree of belief is subjective. Well, as Ed Janes beautifully sets out, and as I'll try to capture in a little bit of tomorrow's lectures, probability is subjective. It depends on the available information. And if you've got different information from me, then you might well arrive at different probabilities and different inferences. But subjective is not the same as arbitrary. We should be able to work out probabilities in a manner that if somebody else comes along with exactly the same data, then he or she should calculate the same probabilities as you. So if you've got the same background information and you use the same methods of analysis, then two observers should actually assign the same probabilities. That should be our goal. And hopefully, by the end of tomorrow, I'll have given you some insights as to how we go about doing that, assigning probabilities in a manner which is certainly subjective, but isn't arbitrary. It's reproducible from one experiment to another.